a visit right now, sir? I asked. Yeah, we're moving out. I've been waiting for a weapon here before deploying. Now that you're back, we're heading back into the streets at dawn.
Dawn, I said, checking my tapper. I had 6 hours to rest. My eyes closed and I saw strange images. I was so tired that my brain was playing dreams on the inside of my eyelids, despite the fact Leeson was still talking to me. Dreaming or not, I was awake enough to respond to Leeson.
Don't you want to know where we're headed?
He asked. Not really, sir.
Damn, you're one cool customer, McGill. I didn't think you'd turn out this way when you first mustered in. To me, you looked like a giant screw-up. Oh, and thanks for covering for me with Graves about that debacle at the bank. I was worried that when I caught my revival, I'd be put right back down again.
I opened one eye and looked at him blearily. I realized that was why he'd really come in here to talk to me the minute I'd come back from the revival machine. He wanted to thank me, and maybe to make sure I wasn't going to screw him at this late date by talking about old Silver and his bribes. The odd thing was, I hadn't tried to protect Leeson when I'd made my report. I guess I could have told Graves what I thought of Leeson's decision to go along with Claver, but I was so pissed at Germanica's silver-haired devil that I hadn't even considered my immediate commander's lack of good judgment. Funny how things worked out sometimes. I forced an upward twitch of my lips and closed both eyes again.
No big deal, sir. Could have happened to anyone.
See you at dawn, then, Leeson said, and left.
Lying on my bunk, I thought about what had happened out there with Claver and the rest of my platoon. Was Claver involved with all this violence spreading across the city? I didn't see how he could be at the bottom of it, but then he was a wily old bastard. As I passed from wakefulness into a deep, soulful sleep, I wondered if Claver was still alive out there somewhere. The odds were against it, with enemy rebels killing every legionnaire they caught in the streets. Claver's silver hair represented an amazing accomplishment in survival, but I'd realized by now it wasn't a heroic achievement. It had been done through trickery and deceit. Yeah, he could be alive. The more I thought about it, the more I thought it was likely. Old Silver was as impossible to kill as a slippery river rat. I felt sure he'd survived out there somewhere. Somehow. I woke up late with about 25 minutes to shower, dress, and shove food into my mouth. I was still chewing when I rammed my helmet down over my head and jogged down to the rally point. All right, line up. Harris roared, marching along the line like we were a bunch of day-old recruits. I resented his attitude, nothing new for me, but I lined up with the rest of them. Harris paused in front of me and narrowed his eyes.
Glad to see you felt like joining us today, McGill.
Wouldn't miss this for the world, vet.
Carlos was there, as were Keevy and even Natasha. It was old home week, and as always, I felt strange looking at faces I'd seen dead in the mud, what seemed like only a few hours ago. That is not to mention the disconnected feeling that came along with knowing my own eyes had been as dead as rubber just last night. I did my best to shake it off and get into the mission. Whining about death was amateur hour in Legion Varus. When we'd all gathered, Centurion Graves appeared and stepped calmly forward to address the unit.
People, I'm not going to lie to you. Just about everyone here has died at least once over the last 72 hours. I'm here to thank you for your commitment to the cause and to inform you, regretfully, that your sacrifice is not yet done.
We tried to stay cool, but this wasn't Graves's usual sort of opener. I sensed, more than saw, people fidgeting and exchanging glances along the ranks. Graves wasn't sounding as overconfident as he often was. He was downright apologetic. I couldn't recall a similar briefing. The screen behind him lit up from the floor to the ceiling. I was glad not to see Turov's leering face up there. Instead, a diagram of the city appeared with varied colors for levels of conflict and numbers indicating districts. Our position was in the middle of District 14, a relatively calm region of the city that glowed a cool green. I was surprised by how many areas were yellow, orange, and red, even purple, a color that indicated we'd lost the zone and given up on it.
"As you can see here," said Graves, gesturing with his hands as if he were grabbing leaves and plucking them from an invisible tree. "The lower decks around the vents and the umbilical region have been lost to the enemy and are now shown in violet. The red zone contains enemy troops, but fighting still goes on there between government forces, Legion troops, and the rebels. By my estimate, I'd say a third of the city was violet or red. I immediately suspected that the enemy controlled all of that, and that we were making incursions and patrols now and then to look like we cared." His hands shifted, spreading his fingers, and the view zoomed sickeningly. The see-through outline of Gelt Station itself whirled around like a top, and we came in from a different angle, focusing on the orange zones.
"The mid-decks are residential," he said without any inflection. "We're fighting in the streets here block by block. The fighting is heavy at times, but quiet right now. Tonight's mission involves Residential 6, an affluent neighborhood directly below the financial district. Intel estimates this region is a key target for the enemy."
I had to suppress a snort of disbelief. I wondered what kind of genius adjunct had figured that one out. These Tau thought of nothing but money most of the time. I wasn't at all surprised they were trying to take over the banks. Hell, that might be the whole point of the uprising in the first place. Graves made an erasing gesture, and the three-dimensional image of the station vanished. He brought up camera feeds from the streets. My interest immediately rose. Here were the faces of the enemy. I could see them, and they looked grimly determined. There were more of them in the streets now. Throngs. They were suited up in dull maroon and shimmering silver. I again wondered at the significance of those colors. I figured they must be working-class proles from the planet's surface. Only 1 in 10 of them were armed with anything other than a makeshift weapon. Of those officially armed, a few carried lightning rod devices. Others carried... My eyes widened in shock. "Excuse me, sir," I called. Graves looked at me for a moment before waving for me to speak. "Sir, are they carrying Legion regulation weapons?"
"Yes. Yes, very observant," Graves said. I couldn't tell if he was being sarcastic or not. "They have snap rifles for the most part. They took down 2 full cohorts of our light troops last night and distributed the weapons. Notice, also, that most of them are unarmed. Entire squads follow one leader with a real weapon. When he goes down, they pick it up and keep fighting."
I shook my head in disbelief. Snap rifles weren't much, but they were better than regular gunpowder-based ballistic weaponry. They accelerated tiny needles of mass to great speeds and operated with a high rate of fire. I didn't want to have to face a mob armed with the same weapons we had. To be shot to death by our own weapons, that would be a tough way to go down. What was surprising was that they'd managed to get so many weapons from our troops. They must have killed the light troops pretty fast to keep their grip on them. Our Legion recovery teams put a priority on weapons retrieval. They were much more important than bodies or uniforms.
"Perhaps I should recap what we've learned of this conflict for those of you who've been out of the picture for a while," Graves said, pointedly looking at me. "The unrest on the surface has been growing for years. Tau is a world of contrasts. A few have great wealth, but due to their unrestricted population growth, most are poor. Only the wealthy few make it up here into space to seek their fortunes. All of that background information was available on the Legion website, and you should have read it on the flight out here. What's different today," he continued, "comes down to 2 key elements. One,
They managed to get a large shipment of powerful alien weapons. 2. The population of this world has learned of Imperial weakness. It was bound to get out, and the first world to hear about it was this one, a merchant hub of local trade. They know that the local battle fleet has been called to the core systems. We've been left in charge. How does that look to them? Well, they've seen a scrim of fancy troops courtesy of Germanica for years. The rebels on the planet's surface weren't impressed. They've decided to make their move before the Empire ships come back.
Carlos, of all people, raised his hand. Graves ignored him and pointed to Natasha.
Sir,
she asked,
why were they holding back?
I mean, the Empire doesn't care about the purely internal affairs of any system. They could have a civil war and a bloodbath without a threat from the Imperial fleets.
That's not true in this case, Graves said. Remember that Gelt Station is the hub of interstellar commerce. Aliens are here on legitimate Imperial business. If they destroy an alien trade ship without good cause, they risk sanction by the fleets if they come back. The ultimate sanction.
Natasha frowned.
Did you say, if the Imperial fleets come back?
I should have said when. In any case, their return might take a long time.
The entire subject of warfare among the core systems was the topic of countless whispered conversations among the troops, but our officers rarely brought it up. I was alarmed at the idea that Imperial ships might never return. How could the Empire hold together in its current form if they didn't? At some point, an alien civilization would grow bold and attack another. At that moment, the galaxy would change forever. I hoped someone back on Earth was thinking about these things and working up some kind of plan to deal with the situation.
A long time, sir?
Carlos blurted out of turn.
The fleet might not return for
what?
Are we talking years here or centuries? A trip to the core systems takes over a year each way, Graves said. Beyond that, we have no way of judging the situation. If anything, the galactic net is more closely policed than it was before. We're not getting any formal news from the Nerbs or anyone else.
I found it remarkable that Graves was freely passing on this information. I wasn't sure why he was doing it. Maybe it was part of the same disease that had infected the local Tau. They'd figured the cat was gone and may be dead, and they were partying harder every day, celebrating the absence. How long would it be, I asked myself again, before more worlds went wild? Chapter 18. Graves slammed his hands together, ending the briefing and dismissing us with one gesture. We hustled for the armory and loaded up. I decided to go with a heavy kit today. I was done fooling around. I asked the quartermaster for a light artillery emplacement, a floater cart to carry it, plus another cart for ammo.
You know this 88 has a kick? The quartermaster asked, as if I was some kind of rookie. You can't just put it up to your shoulder.
Yeah? I responded. Do you think that's why it has a tripod base? He looked at me with twisted up lips for a second, then sighed and contacted Leeson for approval. Adjunct Leeson backed me up without a moment's hesitation. I was gratified that I had a favor to pull in from him, and I hoped that state of affairs would continue. To my mind, it was best to immediately turn gratitude from a superior officer into something tangible. They tended to forget who they owed very quickly. I had Carlos assigned to drag my ammo cart around for me. You would have thought I'd put a dog collar on him and send him into the snow under a heavy lash.
This isn't cool, he said, dragging the tether line.
The floating cart barely weighed anything from the point of view of the soldier guiding it. The cart even had enough automated brains to follow a man on its own, if you let it. But none of that stopped Carlos from complaining. I've got a cart of my own, I told him, tugging on my tether. My burden was, if anything, bigger and more unwieldy than his was. The entire gun emplacement rode on it. It looked squatty and had a bulbous nose on the front projector. The tripod of legs had a distinctly insectile appearance. Alien 88s always reminded me of beetles with nozzles, but they were deadly at mid-range against large formations.
"I'm supposed to be your friend, not your slave," Carlos continued. "I don't get this at all. Do you hate me, McGill?"
"I just wanted to team up with someone I could talk to," I said. "I guess I was wrong. I'll contact Adjunct Leeson and get you reassigned on point with Keevy."
"Fine, fine, I'll pull your damn cart. No need to get pissy about it."
Carlos was an acquired taste. For some reason, I liked the man. We were still friends despite all the trouble between us. I think it was the fact we'd faced death together so many times. Serious combat welds men together. In our case, it gave us the fortitude to overlook one another's faults.
"We pulled the lucky card on this deployment," Adjunct Leeson's voice crackled in my headset. "We've been assigned the high ground. The best part is, we're not going anywhere near the financial district."
This was news to me and Carlos. We exchanged glances and continued to listen.
"We're going to the high end of the station," Leeson said. "Covering the government buildings. No one expects a serious attack there, as a rentable Tau police force is huddled in those structures. All aboard the skimmer. And remember to hold on, these turtles are crazy pilots."
There were muttered groans and curses as we loaded our gear onto the skimmer. This model had been modified for combat. It still had a low railing, but its underbelly was armored by interlocking plates that looked like fish scales to me. The turtle did his best to make us throw up breakfast, but I think the added weight dampened his efforts. We slewed and wallowed at every banking turn. It was frightening, but not as violent and death-defying as usual. When we at last cruised into the government district, I was happy to see the streets were empty and quiet. Maybe this mission would be the cakewalk we'd been promised. As we landed on a flat section of pyramid-like structure and leapt off the deck, a second skimmer came roaring down near us. Graves himself got off with another platoon. Several more skimmers were following, as three units had been assigned to cover this centrally placed building in the district. The original briefing map had displayed this district as yellow, meaning there was no current combat. But we were bordering enemy forces and had to look sharp. When we touched down, we spread out and moved to cover all the elevators and stairways that led down into the building. Harris took care of that, placing his troop with care. The veteran didn't mess with Carlos and me. We were on our own. Leeson walked over, hands on his hips, and surveyed the roof.
"Over there," he said. "West side. Set up your 88 with the best field of fire you can."
His order was extraneous, but I didn't mind. As long as an officer didn't order me to do something stupid, I was happy. I dragged my artillery piece to the edge of the roof and set it up on a corner. I had a great field of fire down two slanting sides of the building.
"Don't you think we're kind of exposed out here on the corner?"
Carlos asked me as he towed the ammo after me.
"Yeah," I said, "but you can't do much if you can't see anything. This is a line-of-sight weapon. We have to have a clear field of fire."
"What if they have snipers?"
"We're going to build a bunker up here. I thought you'd be happy out here on this roof. The heavy fighting is kilometers away."
Carlos shaded his eyes and looked out toward the financial district to the west. Smoke tails swirled up toward the big exhaust fans, and lurid glowing flames could be seen here and there, dotting the streets. Something was going on out there. We could see that much.
"After they take the banks, where do you think they'll come next?"
Carlos asked me.
I looked at him in surprise.
"Take the banks? Do you think they will?"
Carlos laughed. "I forgot. All you got was Graves' little pep talk today. That's not the whole story."
His statement concerned me. Carlos was always cynical, but I'd felt that Graves had been holding back. I was also worried that Carlos was referring to Graves' speech as a pep talk. To my mind, the briefing had laid out a grim scenario. Carlos knelt and pulled out a portable Puffcrete dispenser. It looked like a big caulk gun and worked the same way. You had to be careful, though, because if you didn't get the material out cleanly in one go, it would harden up and jam the gun. Once it did that, it was almost impossible to reuse. I got down on my knees and joined him. Soon we were squirting out an instant fortification around the 88. It began to take shape, looking like pink-white paste until it hardened. I kept building it up farther out with a larger aperture for firing. It was going to feel weird being perched on the corner of the building and hanging out over thousands of meters of air like I was sitting in a bug's cocoon.
"Listen," Carlos said. "We've lost about half the city over the last 3 days. I got lucky and was revived early. Well, maybe lucky is the wrong word. Anyway, I was ahead of you in line. I got to watch the enemy spread in advance."
For once, I felt no urge to tell Carlos to shut up. He was more serious than usual in his tone as well. I added a reinforced support under the floor of the bunker, attaching it with strands and beads of thick puffcrete, and slathering it into place with disposable trowels.
"Just think of what that means," Carlos continued. "This hab is huge. Just to march as far as they have without fighting would take days. We haven't been holding them back or forming a front. We've been overrun and pressed back at every engagement. They're advancing like a flood, and talk of this being a battle is just wishful thinking."
Carlos had never been one to look at the bright side of a situation, but I had to admit he was right. They couldn't have spread so far so fast if we'd been doing much of anything to slow them down.
"They have sheer numbers," I said. "I understand that. But what about the city population? How can a few thousand, even a few hundred thousand, control millions of civvies?"
"That's just it," Carlos said. "I think they're joining up. I think every neighborhood full of losers they take over is a recruiting ground. The city is rising up. Their ideology, or whatever they're using to get people to fight, is spreading."
I thought about how selfish the Tau were in this place. These aliens only cared about gaining a credit for themselves. I wasn't sure what had gotten them into a fighting spirit. Maybe it was a culmination of hopelessness among the countless poor.
"I bet they aren't all joining up," I said. "Most are probably huddling in their houses, content to let others fight it out."
"That sounds like your average Tau. They don't have much community spirit."
Carlos laughed. "Try none at all. The threat of galactic intervention has always kept this place under control. But that's gone now."
"We don't know that. It's very risky to assume the battle fleet won't come back and exact revenge."
Carlos shrugged.
"Tell them about it."
I looked out of my completed bunker and stared to the west. The smoke clouds seemed a trifle bigger and blacker than they'd been when we'd started. Could the battle be coming closer?
"Break out the goggles," I said. "I want to get a range reading on the riots."
Carlos dug around in our equipment bags and pulled out the goggles, but he didn't hand them over. Instead, he pulled the strap over his own head and stared through the telescoping lenses making adjustments.
"Come on, hand them over," I said.
"I'm your spotter, and I'm spotting something right now."
Rather than standing around, I got into my gunner's harness and tried out the swivel controls on the 88. They felt good. I trained with some light artillery pieces like this one over the last 6 months, but had yet to use them in combat. I liked the way the 88 felt. The handholds on the back were like vertical bicycle handlebars. With my gauntlets off, they were cool to the touch, and the swivel motion was very smooth. A lot of alien tech was awkward to use. Even the systems they built for use by humanoids. There was always something extra or something missing that made it hard for a human to operate. For example, most seats had a hole for a tail to hang out the back. That was fine if you needed it, but when a human sat in such a chair, it felt like your butt was being squeezed into a tail hole after a while. The 88 didn't have a tail hole or a gripping system that was built to be operated by three or four hands at once. It was easy to control and bi-manipulative by design. I could swing the muzzle either up, down, or sideways almost effortlessly. The sights were good, too. I could zoom in, and doing so automatically narrowed the projector aperture for longer-range precision fire. Zooming out widened the cone of impact, but it was still a pretty tight beam compared to the old shoulder-mounted Belcher units I was most accustomed to.
"I think you're going to get to fire that thing after all," Carlos said.
I glanced up at him. He was crouching at my side, intently staring into the goggles and trying not to move at all. I could tell by the way the goggles had telescoped out to nearly a foot in length that whatever he was looking at was pretty far away. "You checking out the banks?"
"Yes, I am. And it looks bad. There are Tau everywhere. I think they just took over the banking buildings. The streets are overrun."
"Crazy," I said, staring at the horizon. Without a visual aid system, all I could see was a pall of smoke. "Why are so many joining in? What's the payoff for them?"
"They must think this is their chance. Only one Tau in 1,000 has any real money, you know. They all lust for more. I think they're willing to burn their whole city down for the chance to get it."
"But they have to know that we're going to burn them down when they get here. I mean, they might win in the end, but they're going to take horrid losses. What would make them so willing to sacrifice themselves?" Carlos shook his head and took off the goggles. He looked troubled, and that was unusual for him. In fact, this entire conversation wasn't how discussions normally went with Carlos. He was usually as self-centered as the Tau themselves.
"I don't know," he said. "Did I tell you I fought them in the streets the second day, after you were killed at the umbilical transport hub?"
"No, but it looks like you survived."
"I did. Let me tell you, it wasn't pretty. They came at us near the shopping malls that surround the city's green area, you know, what passes for a park. They swarmed us like lemmings. We burned so many down, they might have won, except most of them didn't have good weapons. Women, even a few of their young, they were all fighting and dying like animals. But only the Tau. Did you notice that? None of the foreign population has joined in with them. Only the Tau are fighting."
Frowning, I put on the goggles and studied the throngs that marched slowly closer, like ants. Carlos was right. They were only Tau in the horde. I noticed another thing. They were all wearing the same colors, maroon and silver. What the hell did that mean? "Stay on station," I told Carlos. "I'm going to go talk to Natasha." Carlos grinned, and the moment I got out of the gunner's harness, he slipped into it and began slewing the gun mount around. "That's not a toy, Legionnaire," I said.
"I know that. Don't you think I know that? I know when I'm manning a real gun. This feels great. I almost hope the squid faces make it all the way up these streets to us."
I smiled thinly. That sounded more like the Carlos I knew. Whatever twinge of guilt and worry he'd been feeling, it was gone now. Leaving him at the gun emplacement, I went out onto the roof again to find Natasha. I hoped she'd have answers. She often did. Chapter 19. As we were stationed on the flat top of a gigantic pyramid-like building, I had to walk 100 meters or so to our central encampment. I found Natasha there, setting up a large bunker that looked like a bubble of puffcrete on the building's roof. The skimmers had lifted off and left us by this time, and the bunker she was spraying into existence squatted next to the newly outlined air vehicle landing zone. After helping her set up the bunker, she deployed a weapon system inside it. I examined her weaponry with a critical eye. "Anti-air?" I guessed.
"Automated drone turrets," she said without looking up. "They work well for this kind of fortification, as long as you can trust their friend or foe programming."
Can we trust it?"
"Of course," she said, a little abruptly. "I edited the scripts myself."
"Must be good, then. You got a second to talk?"
She glanced up at me and shook her head. "You never quit, do you?"
"What?"
"Am I the last female on the roof? or have you already hit on everyone else up here today?
What?
I asked again. No, I mean, I'm not hitting on you. I want to know something.
Natasha turned back to her anti-air drone. She began studiously messing with her turret scripts. That was real work, but I wasn't fooled.
I've been dead for several days, I pointed out. Not fooling around with women, in case you're under some kind of misconception. Did somebody tell you a story?
She heaved a sigh and faced me.
I guess I'm not being fair. You don't always connect well with women.
I blinked in confusion. To my mind, I was something of an authority on connecting with women.
What's this about?
I asked, trying to stay on neutral ground.
Anne Grant.
The bio? Yeah, she revived me.
She told me she had a date with you and asked if that was cool with me. I told her it was. I told her she could marry your ass if she wanted to.
I was beginning to catch on. My mind whirled around, twice, I think, then came to a stop.
Did she say yes?
Natasha frowned.
Yes to what?
To the marriage idea. Her hand snapped up fast, but I leaned my head back and she missed.
Look, I said, I was dead. For 3 whole days. Can a man get a break after that?
She heaved a sigh.
Maybe. But it seems like I cut you breaks all the time. Do you recall we slept together that last night on Earth when this whole vote thing started?
Of course, I think of it constantly. Her lips formed an unnatural pattern. I wasn't sure if she was disgusted or annoyed.
Then why have you barely talked to me since? On the whole flight out here, you never brought it up. When we got here, we never went out on the town or anything. You knew I wanted to hit the markets and find some cool tech, but you forgot all about that.
Huh, I said. What I remember is going on a crazy gun-running mission, then dying in battle with Tau rebels. Nope, no shopping trips were planned or skipped. As if you were going to go out with me even if we were having an easy time here. Truth was, I'd forgotten about her plans and all the excitement, but I knew that wasn't her real problem anyway. What had her upset was Anne.
Natasha,
I said, deciding to switch the direction of the conversation. Is this situation going to damage our odds for mission success? She straightened up in a hurry when I said that. Whatever else she was a good soldier. When she needed to, she could bury her feelings like few others I knew.
No,
she said firmly.
All right, then. Forget about my dreams of shopping. Maybe I'm just stressed. It's silly, isn't it? This hab is in the middle of some kind of civil war. I shouldn't be asking you about this at all. Sorry, Specialist McGill.
I forced a smile, even though I knew dropping back away from a first-name basis wasn't a good omen.
Great. Here's why I came to you. In your opinion, what's with these crazy rebels?
She frowned.
You mean why are they fighting? I'm not entirely sure.
Neither am I. What we know is that they're going completely batshit, and the effect is spreading. Could it be drugs? Some kind of secret plan or cult we don't know about? Usually the Tau are only motivated by selfish profits. What would make them rise up as a single mass and attack us?
Natasha tapped her face with a finger, puzzling it out.
I could tell I'd managed to intrigue her as well as deflect her from asking any more unwelcome questions about Anne Grant.
That's a damned good question, James.
I dared to let a smile creep back onto my face. I was James again, not that cold-hearted bastard, Specialist McGill.
You're right, she said thoughtfully. Why the hell are the Tau acting like lemmings? It just doesn't make sense. After I set this up, I'll do some checking around. Some of the other techs must be working on enemy behavioral models.
Great, I said. I considered giving her a hug, but passed on the idea. I beat a hasty retreat instead. A man has to know when he's been let off easy and not give in to the temptation to go for broke.
Before I even made it back to the little bunker on the corner of the roof that housed Carlos and my 88, the situation changed. An alarm tone sounded in my helmet. I'd had the visor up, but now snapped it down reflexively. I checked the sky, but found it empty. Natasha's air defense drone was in low scan mode, which indicated it hadn't detected a threat. The rest of the troops around me on the roof were doing the same thing I was. We looked at each other, mystified. If the attack wasn't coming via air, where was it coming from? My helmet crackled and a familiar voice broke into the chatter of confused troops.
This is Graves. Finish those puffgreet bunkers immediately and get to your assigned positions. We're about to have company. The Tau are coming up from the subways and should be visible in the streets soon.
I broke into a run and reached my bunker in 10 strides. I put a gauntlet on Carlos's shoulder and pulled him around. Get out of my chair, Spotter, I shouted at him. He rolled out of the harnessed gunner's seat, grumbling. He struggled with the spotter's goggles.
What's the deal?
He asked. I have no idea. I climbed into the harness and strapped it in as quickly as I could. Right away, I could tell he'd fooled with all my settings. My balls were smashed up against the barrel, and my knees were up so high my legs were almost bent double. Damn it, Carlos, did you have to fool with the seat?
Sec,
he said, slapping a button on the side. The seat immediately moved, whirring. I was eased back into a reasonable position and grunted with relief.
I preset the unit for you and me both, Carlos said.
Frowning at him, I narrowed my eyes. Why? You're not qualified to shoot this thing. You're a spotter, not a weaponeer.
That's true, he said. But remember how you got rank? Your weaponeer died on Steel World, and you picked up his gun. I just figured, well...
Hoping they take out your gunner so you can be a hero, huh?
He shrugged. Worked for you.
I'm feeling the love here, I said. Now give me a range to that subway entrance a block west.
1.4,
he said after playing with the goggles for a second.
These things are great. They take all the guesswork out. Holy shit!
I didn't even ask what he was talking about. I swiveled smoothly, aiming my projector down into the streets. The Tau were boiling up out of the subway. The street filled with flickering shadows like blurs of somber color. Target sighted, Command, I said into my headset. Do I have permission to fire?
How many have you got on your side of the building, McGill?
Graves asked in my ear. Looks like all of them, sir.
Roger that. Same thing on the other side. Take them down before they reach the building. We can't let them get inside the barricades downstairs.
The leading elements of the charge were already roaring forward and hitting the base of the pyramid I sat upon. I took a deep breath and squeezed the trigger bars with my gauntlets. The 88 didn't make a loud sound when it fired, but a lot of hot air blasted out of the thing's sides. Carlos was caught by surprise and almost had his goggles blown off his head. The biggest problem with large-scale plasma weapons when used in an atmosphere was the overproduction of heat. My 88 was no exception to that rule. It seemed to generate almost as much heat from the housing as it did from the muzzle. Like machine guns of the past, the metal swelled up and the entire thing could malfunction from overuse. As I didn't have any barrels to change out, I had to make sure it didn't get too hot. The meter was tapped into my HUD and displayed inside my visor. The first blaze of plasma only lasted about a second, and by the end of it, the temperature was already up into the yellow zone on my internal monitors. Using the burst as efficiently as I could, I swept the beam in a broad swath across the mob at the base of the building. They were so bunched up, I couldn't miss. How many did I kill? I'm not sure. Maybe 1,000, but probably less. I doubted this crowd had ever seen that level of firepower before, and they reeled back in shock. It had to be a surprise to see 20 ranks ahead of you turn to ash all at once, with nothing but a cloud of hot gas and seared individuals at the edge of the killing zone to clue you in as to what had just happened. My weapon cycled up to a full charge again, and the temperature fell into the green. But I held my fire. Graves noticed immediately that I'd stopped firing.
McGill, are you injured?
Negative, sir.
Why aren't you firing your weapon?
They're falling back, sir.
And they were.
They were stumbling, reeling, and dragging their dead toward the subway entrance.
Are they dragging wounded?
He asked.
Yes, sir. Good, all right. Hold on to that cannon of yours for a second.
I heard him then, up along the rim of the building's roof. He ordered a unit of light troops to the edge. I saw them hustle and kneel there, aiming down into the crowd. Graves was the senior centurion present, and he had been put in charge of the defending units. Light weapons began to chatter.
Snap rifles? Carlos asked. He gazed down into the streets. They're chewing them up.
I felt a little sick. It was one thing to burn down a raging mass of enemy troops who were hell-bent on killing you. It was quite another to shoot retreating civvies in the back. Slapping the release on my harness, I climbed out of the bunker and walked along the wall to Graves' position.
There you are, he said. Do you know what I'm doing, McGill?
Killing retreating civvies, sir?
He glanced at me in irritation. No, I'm wounding them. These troops are aiming low.
I looked up and down the line. It was true. The light troops had their sniper barrels attached and were popping single rounds down, choosing their targets with care.
An army seeks to wound opponents,
Graves told me with the air of one delivering a lecture.
That's preferable to killing them. Each wounded enemy takes another man to care for him.
The Tau don't have a big history of caring for their fellows, I pointed out.
True enough, but maybe they'll become demoralized and less wildly excited about charging us.
I see, sir.
You don't approve?
That's not my place, sir. I'm not in command here. Graves looked at me. I avoided his eyes and stared down into the streets. The civvies were falling back, being driven underground like animals. Hundreds of wounded lay squirming all over the streets.
That's right. You're not in command,
Graves said sharply.
And you never will be if you don't learn a few things.
Can I ask a question, sir?
If you must.
What's so important about this particular building?
It's an armory, a government armory.
Shocked, I turned my full attention to the centurion. A government armory? Why are we the ones protecting it?
You'd think that the government forces would be interested in doing so, wouldn't you? Well, they're not. They work for pay and are willing to take a certain degree of risk. But they were unnerved by this crazy crowd. They abandoned the district hours before we got here.
The streets were empty now except for the crawling injured and the smoldering dead. We can't let these crazies have real weapons, I said. They'll be unstoppable.
Now you understand the true importance of our defensive mission.
Yes, sir, I do.
Can I ask you a question, McGill?
Of course, Centurion.
The next time I order you to kill 1,000 murderous hostiles, civvies or not, will you follow that order instead of fucking around?
There was sudden vehemence in his statement. He was pissed off and he had a good point. Our eyes met. Yes, sir, I said. Sorry, sir. Graves's attention drifted back toward the streets below, which were nearly quiet now.
That was only the first wave, he said. Their ranks have swollen, but their weaponry hasn't. Only 1 out of 20 of them have a real weapon. They must capture this armory.
I nodded grimly. I understand. They won't get past me, sir.
Excellent. Back to your post, Specialist.
Chapter 20. Our district of the city fell silent for the next few hours. The power went out late, then came back on, then went out again. I didn't think orbital megahabs were built to operate without power, and I was right. When everything shut down, ominous groaning and grinding sounds began emanating from the roof vents. I knew these noises were bubbling up from the distant machinery below the streets. When the generators died the second time, the city streets fell into a strange twilight. The city itself was as black as space, but beams of overly brilliant starlight streamed in from outside the station, cutting like cold lasers through the gloom. After a few more hours, the air became stale and the whole place seemed haunted. By listening to reports from other parts of the city, I came to fully understand how badly this battle was going. It was our side that had cut the power, hoping to slow the rioters down. But apparently it wasn't working. The enemy was advancing all over the city. They seemed unstoppable. Once again, I found myself wondering where old Silver was. He had to be out there somewhere. Was he working with the Tau, openly? I didn't trust that man in any way, shape, or form. He'd known too much about this rebellion from the beginning. At about midnight, Natasha showed up and stuck a tablet in my face. It showed a graphic app depicting Tau attire. You could flick your finger over it and change their dress to anything you wanted, and a caption would appear underneath telling you what it meant. "Cool vid game," I said. "Did you figure anything out?"
"Try the app," she said, pushing it into my hands. "Make it look like one of the rebels."
I sighed and did as she asked. I toyed with the app, but I soon found myself frustrated. "It doesn't seem to work," I said. "The maroon and silver, you can't select that."
"That's right," she said. "I don't know why, but apparently no one ever chooses that combination. Either that or the app designers don't know what it means."
"Huh," I said, shrugging. "That's weird." Natasha rolled her eyes.
"It's not just weird, James. It's part of the answer."
"What answer?"
"The answer to why these people are acting so oddly."
I frowned, chewing that one over. "Are you saying that if we could get these clowns to change their holographic clothing back to normal, they'd settle down?"
"I'm not sure, but I'm trying to figure that out."
"We should tell someone about this,"
said Carlos, leaning his big face in between us. I pushed him back with my hand.
"No, you don't. This is Natasha's find. She'll take it to the brass herself and get the credit."
He glared at both of us.
"How the hell am I supposed to get rank if you guys won't cut me a break?"
"Do something useful," I suggested.
"I'm going to do just that. I'm going to take a leak over the side of this building."
He stalked off into the night.
"Take the app to Graves," I told Natasha.
"I already did. He said he'd mention it in his next report to the Primus."
"That sounds like bullshit," I said.
"Yeah."
I thought hard for a second, then came to a decision. The more I thought about it, the more this tidbit of information seemed critical. Legion Varus was losing this fight, and we needed an edge to change the tide. Understanding the cause of the uncharacteristically violent behavior of the Tau might be just what we needed.
"I'm going to contact Tribune Drusus," I said.
"He told me to tell him if something like this ever came up. I'm not sure he really meant that, but he can always give me the finger if he wants to."
"James, he told you that during a different campaign on another planet."
"Yeah, well, I finally got around to it." Natasha looked nervous.
"You're really going to walk right over Adjunct Leeson, Centurion Graves, and our new Primus?"
"Why not?"
"I'm not sure I want my name on this anymore."
"Why is everyone a chicken when it comes to talking to officers?" I asked.
"Because they can execute us."
"Been there," I said. "It's not that bad." She laughed and handed me the tablet.
"Be my guest, James."
I smiled at her. "Give me a kiss for luck." She hesitated, then did it. I wouldn't call it a lingering, passionate kiss, but it was the real deal. I wondered if this particular copy of my body within which my consciousness currently resided might get lucky before I got him blown up somehow.
"Damn you,"
she said almost to herself. Then she left. Looking at the tablet, I tapped it again, trying to get the configuration right. I couldn't do it. There was no maroon suit, no silver shoes either. Sucking in a deep breath, I contacted the Legion commander, Tribune Drusus. I was shocked when he answered my text immediately with a voice channel. I touched a glowing dot on my tapper and heard a familiar, sonorous voice in my earpiece.
"McGill, are you overrun at your position?"
"No, sir, everything's quiet here."
"A social call, then. There's a battle going on in 2 districts. I don't have time."
"Sir," I said, "I wouldn't contact you to ask you out to dinner. Not today, anyway."
"All right, then," he said after a moment's hesitation. "What have you got?"
Talking quickly, I told him about Natasha's discovery concerning the Tau holo clothing. He listened politely, but didn't seem impressed. I'm failing to see the significance of this discovery, interesting though it is. The Tribune told me. It's only logical to me that the rebels would choose a non-standard set of colors to identify one another on the battlefield.
I think it's more than that, sir, I said.
The Tau use their appearance to project mood and to infect one another with their thoughts. Every color combination they wear is significant. This one is unknown to us. But Specialist Elkin believes they're spreading the rebellion with these colors, signaling others to join them.
I didn't say that,
Natasha hissed behind me. I waved her off and listened to the Tribune. Hmm, Drusa said. That's an interesting idea. We're new here, and I do recall that the Tau present emotion, mood, and intent with their colors. They used to do it with physical dress, but now use these holographic projections. You're saying that if we change their projections, we could quell these riots?
I don't know, sir, I admitted. But it's got to be worth investigating. We can't kill every civvy on this station.
You're right about that. They outnumber us by about 100,000 to 1. All right, hold your position. When your current mission is complete, I'm giving your unit new orders to investigate the matter.
Thanks, sir. We'd be glad to help. But isn't there a tech unit that would be better suited to...
No, there isn't anyone else I can spare. Besides, I think learning the truth of the matter will require a full combat team before you're done.
How long is our current mission going to last, sir? I asked.
I suspect it will all be over by morning.
Drusus closed the channel, and I was left frowning down into the dark streets.
What did he say?
Natasha asked.
We're going to be reassigned. We'll be sleuths after we're relieved from our position up here.
You've got to be kidding me. You went over Graves' head, and now he'll be slapped with new orders because of it? He's not going to like that.
Yeah, I agreed, but I barely cared about Graves' feelings. I was more concerned about what we'd been asked to do next. I'd been hoping to pass the matter off to a team of techs, maybe a full unit of them, but apparently Drusus didn't have the resources free for that. For some reason, I never even questioned Drusus about his declaration that our current assignment would be at an end by morning. I'd simply figured we would be relieved by another contingent of troops by that time. I found out just before dawn that that wasn't what he'd meant at all. The Tau began boiling up out of the subway again, and an alarm sang in our helmets. I hated to admit it, but I'd nodded off in my harness. Carlos rapped his knuckles on my helmet, making a loud knocking noise.
We're in business again, Ace, he said.
I stifled a yawn and sat up, my heart pounding. With bleary eyes, I swung the muzzle of my .88 downward. I twitched it a little to the left as it had drifted, and I squeezed the dual triggers. Smooth, bright death reached down and swept away an unknowable number of Tau. But this time, they didn't fall back. They charged forward, climbing over mounds of steaming dead. Surprised, I rotated the gun on its tracks. The system whirred and clicked. I had to draw a fresh line across the boiling horde of enemies, starting farther forward this time.
You're too far to the right with the muzzle, Carlos shouted. You'll burn open street instead of targets.
He was right. I could see that immediately, but there wasn't time to correct. They were already racing to the base of the building. I struggled to adjust my aim while Carlos shoved a fresh cartridge into the base of the weapon and slapped my shoulder to indicate I was free to fire. The .88 was an odd weapon. It wasn't like operating something as simple as a heavy machine gun. It could only fire in short bursts before recycling and cooling the plasma chamber. You couldn't hose down everything in sight. You had to pre-plan your shots, and you couldn't afford to miss. I squeezed the triggers, splashing my beam down on empty puffcrete. Such was the power of the beam that it vaporized a broad swath of the street's surface, burning about an inch into one of the hardest substances in the known universe. Damn it, I said, straining to swing the muzzle back on target. I was partially successful, and Carlos helped by kicking the chassis and nudging me further into line. The beam finally struck the enemy wave with half the charge expended on nothing. I could tell I was hitting troops as the expanding gases far below in the street changed from dark and thin
to roiling gray-white. That was steam, I realized. Steam from the bodies of the masked Tau I was annihilating.
They made it to the barriers,
Carlo said, lying on his belly and aiming his extruding goggles down the long sloping side of the building.
There's too many. They'll break in. You'll have to sweep the base of the building.
Roger that, I said, tilting the muzzle downward until I was staring directly down the side of the building. It felt like I was going to slide off and fall into the middle of them. Carlos got to his knees quickly and fed me another cartridge. The 88 swallowed that, and the temperature indicators fell from red to orange and down, slowly, into the green. I'd lined up for my third sweep by this time. It was going to be a difficult one, as I'd have to change angles in the middle to go around the corner of the building. But if I could pull it off, I was pretty sure I could repel. I got no further in thought or action. A blinding light and a crackling feeling of current ran through me. For an instant, my world was whiteness and seemed to be spinning. Something hot was in my face, and I tried to push away from it, but the harness I was in kept me held there like glue. My eyes began working again a moment later. Although I was dazed, I was able to take stock of the situation. We'd been hit, taken out. I didn't know where the strike had come from, probably from a well-aimed lightning bolt. Someone down there had figured out who was burning hordes of their troops and had aimed very carefully. Carlos was dead. One of his stick-like goggles was smoking, and the other had been blasted back into his head like a spear. As I watched, his body gently rolled over, then slid down the side of the building, bouncing and flopping all the long, long way to the throngs in the street. The 88 itself was damaged. The muzzle had taken the majority of the hit, and I could tell right away it had unleashed its last broad stripe of death. I shrugged my way out of the harness and crawled out of the bunker. Gaining a little more capacity for cogent thought, I tapped my way into the tactical channel and reported.
Western corner gun emplacement has been knocked out, I said.
McGill,
Graves snapped.
Are you still with us?
I rolled onto my back and stared up at the sky, which was made of fake panels and glimpses of bright, real stars. My HUD said my body was in the green, but I had my doubts.
Yes, sir,
I said, half groaning the words. But I feel like someone has been using my helmet for a church bell.
Good enough. Join Leeson on the stairway. I sent him down into the building.
I frowned in confusion and hauled myself into a sitting position. Every second, my brain operated a little more smoothly.
The stairway, sir?
The enemy has breached the armory. We've lost the bottom floor.
Right. On my way.
Struggling to my feet, I grabbed a snap rifle off a dead sharpshooter. My own gun had been lost when they'd lit up my bunker, and I staggered to the stairs. The scene inside the stairwell wasn't encouraging. Men were shouting, and weapons chattered far below, echoing up the long, long shaft from the ground floor. The enemy was fighting their way upward, and I could tell they weren't in an easy-going mood. Chapter 21. I checked my snap rifle with slightly blurred vision. I knew I probably had a concussion of some kind, but I figured the bio people could give me the details whenever they got around to it, if I lived that long. The weapon I'd picked up was tricked out to be a sniper rifle at the moment. With a longer barrel and a superior scope mounted on top, it had a great deal of range, but a much lower rate of fire. I stepped to the first landing and put my rifle over the edge of the railing. There was a narrow space between the switchbacks on the stairs that allowed me to sight downward 20 floors or so. Spotting a masked, shimmering movement of maroon, I decided to get into the game early. I hadn't handled a snap rifle fitted with a scope in a long time, but it still felt like home to me. I popped off shots and put down an attacker with each round. After a dozen or so hits, my helmet crackled.
"Who's out there with the snap rifle?"
Leeson demanded.
"It's McGill, sir," I said. "Get down here, damn it! I need your heavy weapon on the front line. I've lost my 88, and it wouldn't make it down 20 flights of stairs anyway."
There was a stream of curses. Apparently Leeson had forgotten in all the excitement that I'd come into this fight with a gun on a tripod.
All right, he said. No belcher, huh? Nothing more useless than a weaponeer without a weapon. Just keep popping them as they come up the stairs.
I was happy with those orders as I was still feeling a little woozy and didn't feel like jogging.